Here in New York, we have Ann Berry with us, our guest for the half hour. Ann is founder and managing partner at Threadneedle. And it's a pleasure to see you in person after we've moved beyond COVID and the situation that we've been in for nearly the last 3 years now. I want to begin with the Disney story, because one of the things that struck me was this move on the part of an activist fund, Trian Fund Management. Mm-hmm. They picked up a position in Disney before the last earnings report, or in the days following, I should say, and we know that was a huge disappointment. When it comes to an activist looking at a company like Disney, give me a little bit about what the thinking is, how an activist investor approaches a situation like this where you need to create change in order to realize value.
Doug, it's really important too. Trian is not just any activist investor. This is Nelson Peltz. So as you look at someone who's really been in this game for a long time, this really is one of the more forward-leaning. When activists look to take big positions in companies, and in this case, Trian took about $800 million into Disney, those funds are looking at these public companies really in the same way that the private equity industry would think about taking private one of these businesses. They're looking to take out costs very aggressively. They're looking at capital allocation and return on equity in these businesses in a much more forward-leaning fashion. And they're looking at ways to turbocharge revenue growth in a cost-efficient way, all the same ways that private investors assess companies. But it's a little bit of a different mindset when you're looking at the public space.
Give us an idea what is different then, if you don't mind, Ann.
Sure. Well, if you were to think about, Rish, the way in which private equity looks to create change in their portfolio, we do it without having to worry about near-term impacts to earnings per share. We do it without having to worry what the public gaze means in doing some very difficult things, in restructuring, in headcount reduction. And so when you're doing this in the public domain in response to having an activist, you're doing things that are sort of uncomfortable as a public company, with a lot more urgency, and where you're having to go to the analysts, the research community, and say, have patience with us as we take some near-term losses to get these longer-term gains. It's a very different way of looking at public market performance.
I'm going to put you in a tight spot very quickly. We'll continue the conversation in part two, but would you expect Bob Iger to make some major changes now that he comes back?
Doug, I think he's absolutely no choice but to do it. And just as we were coming on air, I at least saw something trending, still to be verified, that notices were already going out to Hulu employees to start anticipating reductions.
And we saw Zoom's earnings come out. I don't want to spend too much time on individual companies, but earlier, and they did actually record their slowest growth ever. But again, they did have profits which were ahead of analyst estimates. It must be very difficult for this company given the end of the pandemic. Are they making the right moves? And the reason why I ask is it's amazing that they still are actually growing at all, given that people are returning to the office. And secondly, did they repair the roof while it was sunny?
Rish, I completely agree with that sentiment of it's sort of amazing they're growing at all. And to take a big step or to zoom out, if you look at Zoom and you look at DocuSign, two of the big work from anywhere stocks, I think there's a bigger existential issue. I don't think either of those companies needs to exist on a standalone basis.
So let's talk about the residue from the pandemic as it applies to cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
This was something that gained a lot of traction during the whole COVID thing, people finding alternative ways of putting a lot of money that consumers were accumulating. They thought crypto was it seemed like a good play. What have we learned as a result of the implosion of FTX?
Do you mean, Doug, was it a digital tulip?
It may have been.
Is that the question? Or a tulip NFT almost in current, you know, pseudo-currency format? I think, look, FTX, and you know, I've talked about this before, captured the imagination in the sheer scale it was able to reach, in the quality of the investors it was able to tap, and the sheer number of users it was able to get to engage with its core products. And the fact that it's imploded in such a dramatic and accelerated fashion, I think, has shattered confidence in investing behind blockchain. When you look at the numbers from the beginning of 2021 to the end of Q2 this year, between $6.5 and $9.5 billion a quarter was being deployed privately to invest into the crypto adjacent sectors. I think it's going to crater to nothing by the end of this year.
And the thing is, all right, you know, I think everybody kind of agrees that the blockchain, the technology behind a lot of these cryptocurrencies is certainly something which is a game changer. But what's the point of the currencies themselves?
Rish, I am full disclosure, I have never bought cryptocurrency. So you're talking to someone who's never really believed in these tokens as a means of exchange, a store of value. I think the question of what is the point of them has been called into question. And I think Bitcoin is yet to see the trough as people continue to ask themselves, why do these exist and are they credible alternatives to traditional currency?
So the negativity that we've seen expressed in markets, is there a risk of contagion in terms of the way that it may affect sentiment going forward? Does this have kind of the ability to infect more negativity just and cause the markets to become a little bit more conservative, especially as we're looking out into 2023? We've got tighter Fed policy. We don't know where the Fed is going to take us. I mean, there's just so much out there to be concerned about right now.
Doug, I don't see risk of contagion. I think that the focus on crypto and blockchain specifically will remain focused in terms of looking at catastrophic losses, in terms of really large-scale bankruptcies. I think that will remain narrow to that space. Where I do think sentiment will be impacted, but perhaps positively, is in forcing investors to be disciplined again. What FTX highlighted was the quality of diligence, perhaps fraud,
or lack
something
of.
Else, or it was perhaps not at the standard that people would typically have if there wasn't such a bubblicious frame of mind. And I do think that return to discipline, the return to cash, the return to tangible business models and assets is going to come quickly.
Okay, so you look at the equity markets and then you look in the US and you look at the S&P. I mean, it's yielding, 1.7%. You know, that's nothing compared to what's going on in the bond market. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at also a forward P's of about 17 times earnings. Mm-hmm. That's not historically slightly on the expensive side, but is that the only place you can go?
You know,
of course, the bond market, yeah.
It's slightly on the expensive side relative to history. It's on the very expensive side when you put it in the context of deep macro uncertainty, worsening outlook in Europe, and this point around consumer sentiment being very cuspy here in the United States. So I actually worry, my own personal view is the S&P is going to crack. I don't see it sustaining itself at these levels as we go into the end of the year, and I think there's a downward correction coming as people reframe the outlook for 2023, which I think is going to become more and more negative.
And the Fed is the culprit for driving this. I mean, but they have no choice. If you really believe that inflation is out of control and the Fed has no choice but to get it back in, let's say at a 2% target, I mean, we're looking at a lot more tightening.
I think we're certainly looking at a bit more tightening, Doug, and I think the expectation is that we'll see another 75 basis point hike coming in December, if nothing else, because the Fed has to get a handle on its credibility again, having been so heavily criticized up until this point.
Yep, the problem is that, you know, by trying to reach for your credibility, you might be putting the economy in danger by policy mistakes and perhaps not actually having a little pause to see how a monetary policy is actually at the moment bearing fruit, if at all. And, well, you know, you've got to ask yourself the other question, how much pain are they willing to inflict on the US economy to get inflation down?
Well, I think, Rish, what's interesting so far is while we have seen the stock market correct, we haven't yet seen an impact on the real economy. So, GDP actually was up, right, for the last quarter. We see growth there. We have seen a little bit of softening in the labor market, but certainly not to a degree that would suggest that we're on the recession, a recessionary cusp right at this moment, even though consensus is on a forward-looking basis, 2023 is going to be tough. So until we see the real-time data catch up with the actual targets of the Fed, which, by the way, are not stock market related, I think the Fed's going to have to keep pushing.
How are you feeling about opportunities offshore right now, away from the U.S.? We talk a lot on this program about the situation in Asia. We know what's going on in China, kind of renewed concern about COVID and perhaps a lot more in the way of lockdowns. Are you looking at opportunities in the Asia Pacific? Are you seeing anything away from the U.S. right now?
Doug, I spend more of my time in Europe, so I spend a lot of time in the United Kingdom. I spend time in the continent. And where I see risk at the moment, but risk at some point becomes opportunity because these things tend to overcorrect, is I do think, sitting here in New York, that the US markets do not yet fully appreciate the level of stress that the British and the European consumer is going to feel as energy prices remain as high as they are on that side of the Atlantic. And so for the near term, I see risk, but I'm hoping there's a correction and there's an opportunity to get value in the beginning of next year.
Okay, so where would that value be? I mean, it does seem as though the economies there, particularly the UK, are really, really going to feel it. And you can almost, it's almost palpable that there's going to be a deep recession.
Yeah, I think that's right, Rish. And I think, though, that's where looking at the defensive sector staples over there, you know, one area that is a big part of the British economy, for example, is the defense sector. And I think one area where spending won't be cut because of the secular trend is in defense. So I'm looking at that sector and particularly new technologies touching it quite aggressively.
Could it get a lot worse before it gets better, do you think?
I think that we're going to be in for a very rough Q1. When we're looking at the European stocks, in particular, and the repercussions here in the US, Doug, I don't think yet, despite the fact that we've seen this earnings season, at the beginning of a demarcation between those companies that are getting share gains, wallet share gains, because, you know, there's been a flight to quality. We haven't yet seen the full impact of the strong dollar and weakening global demand. I think that's going to come in Q1.
And the mood music with China seems to have changed, with a lot more of the investment houses becoming interested again and seeing it as being more investable. What's your take?
I do think it's more investable on the near-term tactical basis, Rich. But there's just one overarching comment on China that I think is more of a long-term perspective. If you look back over the last 10 to 15 years of global GDP growth, China has been somewhere between 25 and 33% of the annual growth rates, you know, has driven a large chunk of that. But China has been maturing. You know, China's become very expensive in terms of supply chain and production. And I don't think, yes, perhaps we may have a pop of euphoria as China comes out of the COVID fog. But after that, I don't think we're going to see the same level of GDP growth that we've seen over the much longer term historically with China. And I don't think we've caught up to expectations yet in terms of that slowdown in secular growth coming from that part of the world.
30 seconds for your take on the future of Hong Kong.
The talent drain, Doug, I think has been very disappointing for the Hong Kong market. If I think about the talent that's gone to Hong Kong over the decades, it's been a real hub for entrepreneurs. It's been a real hub for innovation, particularly in finance. You know, when I talk to a lot of friends who've left Hong Kong, they've been very sad to do that. I think with the political uncertainty there, it's a little unclear as to where Hong Kong goes next.
It's always a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks so much for making the time for us. Ann Berry is founder, managing partner at Threadneedle, joining us here on Daybreak Asia. This is Bloomberg.